You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Cordelia Lynch and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, will a murder retrial uncover the Turkish deep state? Our reporter Caleb Lauer looks into the death of Hrant Dink.
To the Armenians, I say this. Try to see some honour in the Turks' denial of genocide. They are saying, as a Turk, me, I am against genocide.
And James Schneider joins us in the studio to set the news agenda. James, what have you got for us today?
Africa's last absolute monarchy, Swaziland, heads to the polls. South Africa's police have been accused of lying to the commission into the Marikana mine massacre. And the International Criminal Court's got problems on three fronts in the continent.
James, coming up a little later. Plus, we head to Helsinki for a design fair. We sit down with renowned chef Elena Arzak. We review the news in Jerusalem, and we might play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The Syrian Deputy Prime Minister has said the civil war in his country is at a stalemate. Khadri Jamil says neither government forces nor rebels are currently capable of outright military victory. He added that if peace talks are confirmed, they would call for a ceasefire at the discussions. Iran says it's willing to help broker a peace deal in Syria, as President Hassan Rouhani said it was part of a move to broaden their political dialogue. That's as the White House says Barack Obama is open to direct talks between Iran and the United States, but only if Tehran is serious about getting rid of its nuclear weapons program. Spokesman Jay Carney told reporters that Mr. Rouhani delivered some positive-sounding rhetoric in an NBC News interview, but actions are more important than words.
It has long been the position of President Obama since he was a candidate that he would, as president, be willing to have bilateral negotiations with the Iranians, provided that the Iranians were serious about addressing the international community's insistence that they give up their nuclear weapons programs. That is the position that we hold today.
A number of people have been injured in another mass shooting in the United States. 11 people have been shot at a basketball court in Chicago, one of those a young child who's in a critical condition. Authorities in Mexico say the number of people killed in storms that hit the country this week has risen to 97. Roads have been damaged, bridges destroyed, and homes buried in landslides after two weather systems converged. Thousands of people have been airlifted by the military from the tourist resort of Acapulco. More than a million people have been affected across the country. 50,000 in total have been evacuated from their homes. The Philippines has evacuated northern coastal villages, suspended ferry services and called in fishing boats as an approaching Category 5 storm gains strength. With winds of 205 kilometres per hour, Typhoon Uzagi is the strongest storm to hit the Western Pacific this year. The International Monetary Fund has urged US policymakers to support major reforms at the global lender and bury political differences over the budget to ease one source of risk to the economy and markets. The IMF agreed to reform its governance structure in 2010 to give greater influence to emerging economies and make China the third largest member. But the reform needs US Congress approval. Managing Director Christine Lagarde said the reforms will give the global financial institution more money to prevent and resolve crises. She also said that global growth remains subdued.
Let me say that while we are seeing some signs of recovery, global growth remained subdued. But the story is more complex. You know, back 6 months ago, we were talking about a three-speed recovery. Well, it's getting a bit more complex than just three speeds. There seems to be multiple speeds at work in a multiple series of transitions.
More than $68,000 in donations have poured in from people around the United States for a homeless man who turned over to police a backpack full of cash. Glenn James found the bag outside a shopping center in Boston. and landed himself in the spotlight on Monday when the police commissioner lauded him for turning over the bag. It contained $42,000 and was eventually returned to its owner. His honesty inspired a man in Virginia to set up a fund to help him change his life, and messages of support, as well as money, have been flooding in since. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. It's 5 minutes past 8 a.m. Here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Hong Kong, Zurich, London, London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26.
From London, London, London,
Caracas. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London, and time now to set the day's news agenda. And today we're joined by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Hello to you, James.
Hi.
What have you got for us?
So Swaziland, which is Africa's last absolute monarchy, it's a tiny country of just over a million people in southern Africa, and they're going to the polls today, which is a bit strange because it is an absolute monarchy and the elections don't really count for very much. Political parties are not quite banned, but pretty much banned. So there are no candidates from parties. And the main opposition group has called for a boycott. But it's a good time to put a little bit of focus on a country that basically only ever gets any news because the king takes another wife. He took his 14th this week. She's a teenager.
A teenager, yeah.
He's not. He's not. I mean, he's 45. He's not. He's not a kind of 80-year-old man with a teenage wife, but still.
She's about 18.
She's about 18, yeah. And she's the 14th. It's not great. It doesn't look good. But that's the only thing that tends to get covered about the country. Whilst there's lots of problems going on there, and there are large calls for reform. A couple of weeks ago, there's meant to be a global week of action organised by the trade union movement there and pro-democracy activists, which just got shut down. People got arrested. A former South African cabinet minister who was there trying to support them got arrested, and things aren't looking particularly good there, even though the king is making some kind of small gestures towards reform.
I mean, you can't bring up an article covering the vote without it having the word sham in the headline.
Yeah.
So given that that is the way that it's being perceived, certainly outside the borders, what level of enthusiasm is there amongst prospective voters for this election,
this
sham
is
or otherwise?
An important point. It's actually reasonably high. So the king does have quite a large level, or you know, has a large level of support in the country, and turnout in elections in Swaziland, you know, sham or not, no effect or not, will be high. We're talking kind of 70-75% turnout. So whilst within the more urban population who might be more closely, might have greater access to pro-democracy activists or trade unions, there might be more of a boycott among the more rural population, which is most of the population. Support for the king is pretty strong, and it works through a structure of local chiefs who promote the candidates that they vote for, and they all seem to be pretty well allied to the king.
We talk about the opposition parties. How small are those factions? You know, some of the arrests within the Communist Party, but is there a sense that there's at least a groundswell of transition or change, or is this kind of deeply entrenched system likely to prevail?
It's probably going to keep on going. Well, it's not going to change just because there are a group of pretty diffuse opposition activists with not necessarily convergent ideologies who oppose him. But he's got massive economic problems, which are just going to get worse. The economy basically only has two things going for it. It's got sugar exports, and then it gets money from the Southern African Customs Union in remittances. And both those could go down over the next few years. Government spending, which is basically supporting the king's pretty lavish lifestyle, is going up, and it's real crunch time. And they're going to need money for budgetary support, which is going to come from South Africa. And it's South Africa that can push the changes within the country more so than the opposition, which is basically just get shut down by the police anytime it tries to do anything.
Well, should we talk about South Africa then?
Yeah.
Because some interesting developments in the fascinating story of the commission into what happened at the Marikana mine.
Yes. So yesterday, the commission, not the prosecutors in the commission, but the commission itself made the pretty bold step of coming out and pretty much saying, we think the police have been lying and we're suspending this until next week. So we can, one, investigate what we think is the new evidence we've discovered, which the police said didn't exist. And so that the police can go and respond to the various allegations that they've lied. But it's not looking good for the South African police force at all, because they have been accused of doctoring evidence, saying evidence doesn't exist when it does, presenting things falsely. And it pretty much comes down to whether there was a shoot to kill order to kill the striking miners or not. Now, the Greg Marinovich, who is a South African journalist from the Bang Bang Club, who's writing for Daily Mavericks, done a lot of the really excellent investigative heavy lifting on this. And he, back a year ago, found lots of evidence that the people who'd been shot hadn't been shot in the original location where the fighting between the striking miners and the police was, but had been shot as individuals, pretty much it looked like as they were running away. And it looked like some people had been shot in the back. And
I believe some at the top of a hill as well, there was some indication.
Yeah, small copy. And it's his story from Monday of this week, which started this, looking at these new videotapes, because the police officer who was before the commission on Monday was pretty much being set up as the fall guy. So it was from his computer that then all the files got transferred to the police computer hard drive that then got given to the Commission of Inquiry.
And there's a sense amongst the local population, at least, of little surprise of this evidence. There's been a strong body of opinion and criticism around, you know, the level at which this might have been premeditated, and some this points towards the idea that this was in fact planned and not, as police say, a reaction to being under threat themselves.
Absolutely. And that's going to be, that could be really damaging going all the way to the top, because it's probably unlikely that the commanding officer who was there at the time, if criminal charges get brought against him or against any of his subordinates, that won't get passed up the line. Why was it that the police were brought out? Why was it that the police were liaising with Lonmin, the company? Why was the mining minister was given information but said we'll let the police and the company deal with it? There are a lot of questions which really go right to the heart of how South Africa's kind of post-94 political and economic situation has been governed. It has been governed with the large mining companies, with disempowered migrant labour, with senior ANC figures being linked to these companies. It's a really important story that gets right to the heart of contemporary South Africa.
Well, let's stay on the continent at least, and on the subject of justice, the ICC. Various different prongs to the ICC and its development this week. What do you want to start with?
The ICC is having massive troubled. So it's got its big case on at the moment, which should be its kind of crowning glory. The first time that a sitting very senior politician, and in this case, the deputy president of Kenya, is facing charges. And that should be good for them. But all week, there's been questions of witness intimidation. The judge had to call on bloggers and social media to please not try to find out who what the identities of the witnesses are who they're trying to hide, because so many witnesses keep dropping out of the case, presumably because of intimidation, or the ICC claim intimidation. So they've got this problem. But Kenya are now going around trying to get as many allies together on the continent for a meeting of the AU next month before the president Kenyatta's case.
So stirring a backlash.
Just stirring a backlash, saying, well, maybe we'll all walk out. There are 34 signatories to the case. Maybe we'll all walk out. And it's looking pretty difficult for the ICC on that front. Then two other quick things. Yesterday, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of Muammar Gaddafi, had a bit of a trial and then it got delayed in Zintan in Libya. He's held by a militia. The ICC want him and they said no. And then thirdly, Omar Bashir, who's wanted by the ICC, the president of Sudan, has put in a request for a visa to go to America, to go to the UN General Assembly. And the ICC is calling on America to arrest him. But this kind of brings to light the awkward fact for the ICC that the reason why lots of people say it's a hypocritical institution and so on is because America isn't a signatory to it. And so America is actually under no legal obligation to arrest him, and in fact might be under legal obligation not to arrest him as the host to the UN.
So a triumvirate of things undermining the ICC really at the moment.
Yeah, and the ICC is having very, very bad press, and there is a significant risk that a large number of African countries, 10 countries maybe, might just walk out, and that would really undermine its ability to act.
James, always interesting to talk to you. James Schneider is editor of Think Africa Press. Thanks for joining us today on Midori House.
Well, coming up, we head to Turkey to find out if the retrial for the assassination of Armenian journalist Hrant Dink will prove another watershed moment in the country's recent history.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, this week marked the restart of a major murder trial in Turkey. Hrant Dink, the Turkish journalist of Armenian descent, was gunned down in 2007 by a teenager recruited, lawyers claim, by the Turkish deep state.
Well, 5 years later, when a court found only the gunman and an accomplice guilty, thousands of Turks took to the streets in protest. Now the case is set for a retrial after the Supreme Court of Appeals overthrew the previous verdict. Caleb Lauer now reports from Istanbul.
Şimdi bir örnek vereyim size. Benim son şimdi açılan davam Ermeni bu bir soykırımdır dediğim için Reuters'a açıldı. O davet ettiğiniz Ermeniler burada sizin.
That was the voice of Hrant Dink. On the afternoon of January 19th, 2007, just before 3 in the afternoon, Hrant Dink was walking back to his Istanbul office when an assassin stepped up behind him and shot him in the head.
Hrant Dink gazete binasından çıkarken başına isabet eden kurşunlarla öldürüldü.
In his newspaper column, published the morning he was killed, Hrant Dink had written, "How real are the death threats? Of course, it's impossible for me to know." In 1996, he founded a newspaper called Agos, the Armenian word for furo, the hole you dig in soil for a seed. The newspaper was something of a revolution, published not in Armenian, but in Turkish. Hrant Dink wanted the paper to explain the Armenian community to Turkish society. Many Armenians here feared and resented letting that society in on the community's conversation. But many other Armenians welcomed a newspaper in a language they actually understood. The newspaper also touched taboos and covered stories very different than what Turks were used to hearing about Armenians.
Sarı gelin.
Take this documentary, for example, made by the Turkish Ministry of Education for the country's middle schools.
In various parts of Anatolia, there are mass graves belonging to Turks.
the results of massacres conducted by Armenians.
The film was eventually pulled, but only because parents complained it was too graphic.
The genocide allegations are used as the philosophical foundation for the establishment of a greater Armenia, much spoken of by Armenians.
Many mistakenly assume Hrant Dink was killed because he called for Turkey to recognize the Armenian genocide. In fact, he argued that reconciliation between Turks and Armenians had to be based on mutual understanding and empathy first, not government views of history.
Türklere diyorum ki, ya Ermeniler niye bu kadar çok ısrar ediyor diye bu sorunun üzerinde durun.
To the Turks, I say this. Dwell for a moment on why the Armenians insist so much on this topic. Be a little empathetic and you might see some honor in their view. And to the Armenians, I say this. Try to see some honor in the Turks' denial of genocide. They are saying, as a Turk, me, I am against genocide. Genocide is a goddamned thing. My ancestors never could have done something like that.
Such views made Hrant Dink unpopular among many in the Armenian diaspora, who were accustomed to vilifying Turkish denial of the genocide. But many also believe this empathy was what made him most dangerous. The beginning of the end came in 2004, when Hürriyet, Turkey's biggest newspaper, carried a report first published in Agos by Hrant Dink. He had reported a claim that Sabiha Gökçen, the adopted daughter of Turkey's founder Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and after whom Istanbul's second airport is named, was in fact an Armenian, orphaned in the genocide. The reaction came hard and fast. The army denounced Dink. Turkish spies warned him. A crowd mobbed the front of the Agos building and placed a black funeral wreath at the door. Rekel Dink, Hrant Dink's widow, said to me years after the murder, "What does a black wreath mean? It means a death is coming, doesn't it?" Hrant Dink was soon put on trial for insulting Turkishness in one of his newspaper columns. In one of his later columns, Hrant Dink wrote that it was as if somebody had pushed a button, putting in motion an orchestrated effort to finally teach him a lesson. In a taxi, Fethiye Çetin, a lawyer who defended Hrant Dink and who is still the family's lead lawyer in the murder case, explained how the court that tried Hrant Dink for insulting Turkishness went out of its way to convict him. One of the most glaring examples of this is when three court-appointed experts from Istanbul University found the column in question did not insult Turkishness, but was in fact a criticism of certain Armenian views of Turks. The court convicted him anyway. Spectators tried to lynch him. The media missed few chances to describe Hrant Dink as the Armenian convicted of insulting Turks. Fethiye Hanım and other friends begged Hrant to leave Turkey, but soon he was murdered.
Hepimiz Hrant'ız, hepimiz Ermeniyiz.
We are all Hrant, we are all Armenian. 100,000 people marched in the funeral procession, most of whom were Turks. The murderer was a 17-year-old boy. We must question the darkness that turns babies into murderers, Rekel Dink told the thousands gathered at her husband's funeral. There were more questions than answers. Cem Halivert is another lead lawyer for the Dink family. The investigation found that the murder was planned in detail with full knowledge of the police. And in the years since, journalists and lawyers have found evidence of further state complicity in the murder. But the courts have so far refused to prosecute any public officials, leaving only the gang of hired hands to which the killing was allegedly assigned as defendants. When the court acquitted most of them and found no conspiracy to commit murder, it had, in the bitter words of Fethiye Çetin, saved the best joke for last. The entire period from 2004 until today has to be seen as a single process, Fethiye Hanım says. When Hrant Dink was put on trial in 2004, it raised his public profile even higher and amplified his status as both traitor in the eyes of his enemies and as a victim. His trial for insulting Turkishness made him even more hated by nationalists, while his work made him dangerous to the nationalist project, advocating reconciliation and empathy as he did. But the tragic irony is, as lawyers agree, Hrant Dink may have been killed by the deep state, primarily and cynically, just to destabilize the government. When the first murder trial ended last year, it seemed to have become the mirror image of Hrant Dink's own trial. Whereas that court went out of its way to convict Hrant Dink of insulting Turks despite the evidence, the court hearing the murder case seemed to have gone out of its way to acquit despite the evidence. The question is, will the new trial be any different? For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Caleb Lauer.
Caleb Lauer there. You are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Cordelia Lynch. It's 8:25 a.m. in London, 10:25 in Jerusalem, and we are heading to Jerusalem now, where we're going to speak to our man there, Joseph Dana. Joseph, good morning. Where would you like to start today?
Well, it's been a busy week with everything that's continuing to go on in Syria, but I want to start in Tel Aviv, actually. So the Israeli Supreme Court had a very significant ruling this week about African asylum seekers, or refugees or migrants. What you want to call them is a very contentious issue in Israel. Effectively, Netanyahu, the prime minister, pushed through an anti-infiltration law a couple of years ago that gives the Israeli police and government forces the ability to detain Africans indefinitely, effectively. These are immigrants that are coming from Eritrea, from Sudan, from other conflict zones in Africa. And as soon as they get to Israel, they're basically thrown in prison. And so the Supreme Court said that this is a unconstitutional ruling, effectively. And now there's been a lot of talk in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem as to what's going to happen next. The court said that up to 2,000 African asylum seekers will have to be released, but that was met by some very, very harsh rhetoric from some right-wing ministers in the parliament. And there was actually a protest against this law in southern Tel Aviv last Tuesday. So it's been a very interesting week on that front.
And leaves Netanyahu presumably in a rather difficult position. Another story for us, Caleb. The Israeli military said it's going to stop using its soldiers to protest.
Indeed. So the Israeli military is going to stop. Well, I'm not sure if you're talking about the protest story, but they're going to stop securing certain border villages and towns near Gaza and Sinai, which is a very interesting kind of event, because one thinks that the Israeli military is there to do exactly that. So basically some military commanders said that they need to kind of move more forces into the West Bank and protect the Israeli settlers in the West Bank, as opposed to operating in these border zones, which is going to be taken over by private security companies. And so this has a lot of people in Israel very, very angry and questioning the rationale of the military. But it does kind of indicate exactly where the priorities of Israel are at this moment, that they kind of leave these border communities out to dry, as it were, and then reinvest kind of a lot of money and a lot of resources into these West Bank settlements, which are so very contentious regarding the ongoing peace talks with the Palestinians.
Well, yes, and another move that's certainly elicited a lot of reaction is the idea of this separation ditch to separate a Jewish and Palestinian neighborhood in the city.
It's really a fantastic piece of news, to be honest. I mean, I've lived in Israel and Palestine now for almost 7 years, and I've seen, you know, the various manifestations of kind of control and occupation and separation that goes on between Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank. And, you know, the separation wall, which has gotten so much attention and which is an ever-present kind of facet of life here. If you drive around these kind of biblical rolling hills and you see this massive, you know, 8-meter high concrete structure, you know, kind of to build on that. And, you know, this news this week that the city of Jerusalem is going to dig a special ditch to separate a Jewish and Palestinian neighborhood in the eastern part of the city is amazing. If you look at it on the surface, you just think this is breathtaking. But having seen all of this kind of stuff develop, you almost, you know, you get accustomed to it. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at this point if the Israelis say, because of the security situation, we're going to have to fill the ditch with water, and it will now be a separation moat. And, you know, maybe they'll put crocodiles in there or something. I mean, it's really kind of just a fantastic situation that people live with on a daily basis.
Joseph, I want to stay briefly on the lighter end of the news agenda. People in Russia who look to the skies today might see an unusual sight, a female Palestinian paratrooper heading towards the ground.
Indeed, there was four female paratroopers, which come from a special Palestinian paramilitary kind of unit that no one's ever heard of, that are now training in Russia. And so the Palestinians, throughout the kind of Palestinian press, there's been these very, you know, very proud kind of photos of these, you know, gallant women jumping out of airplanes in Russia. But it does beg a question as to why exactly they would be training. The Palestinians do not have any sort of air force, and they don't really have any sort of army, and they are living under military occupation. But, you know, that being said, this has been greeted with a lot of real nationalist fervor, and people are happy to see these women. And the fact that they're women is very interesting, you know, jumping out of planes in Russia.
Yeah, I'm sure it would make a compelling sight. Joseph, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Now, in the next half hour of today's programme, we'll report on Finland's largest interior design and furniture fair. We'll review the French newspapers. And in a preview of this week's menu, Marcus Hippie sits down with renowned chef Elena Arzak. But first, David Spencer's here with your news headlines.
Thank you. The Syrian Deputy Prime Minister has said the civil war in his country is at a stalemate. Qadri Jamil says neither government forces nor rebels are currently capable of outright military victory. He added that if peace talks are confirmed, they'd call for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Iran says it's willing to help broker a peace deal in Syria, with President Hassan Rouhani saying it's part of a move to broaden their political dialogue. A number of people have been injured in another mass shooting in the United States. 11 people have been shot at a basketball court in Chicago. Authorities in Mexico say the number of people killed in storms that hit the country this week has risen to 97. More than a million people have been affected across the whole country. 50,000 have been evacuated from their homes. Areas of the Philippines and Taiwan are bracing themselves for an approaching Category 5 storm. With winds of 205 kilometres per hour, Typhoon Usagi is the strongest storm to hit the Western Pacific this year. The owners of the Empire State Building in New York have revealed plans to sell shares in the company. Empire State Realty Trust is aiming to raise $1 billion from listing on the New York Stock Exchange. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 today with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Cordelia Lynch.
Now, Elena Arzak, one of the world's top chefs, is normally busy with her family restaurant, Arzak, in San Sebastian, where she works alongside her father. So her recent trip to London was a rare treat. And the reason for it was Ametsa, a Basque restaurant at the Halkin Hotel in London's Belgravia. She's helped to set it up, and it was her turn to come and see the place.
Well, during her trip, she stopped by at Midori House to speak to Marcus Hippie. Of course, all people in the industry do for this week's edition of The Menu. They spoke about Ametsa, her career, and how it feels to be voted the best female chef in the world. Here's a snippet of their chat.
Personally, I was grew up in an ambience where I was very close to the gastronomy, no? And you can imagine the most important in my family was always the food. And since I was a child, I used to try lots of products, and I adore the food, no? And I love cooking. Of course, you have to love your profession. In my case, it was clear since I was a child, since I was 11, 12 years old. I spent during the summer holidays a small time, 2 hours per day, in the restaurant next to my father, my grandmother, my mother. And I was really fascinated by this ambience. And like in all the professions, you need to work very hard and to have a formation from the base. And it takes long time, so it's not very quick. And it's a mixture between theory and lot of practice, and as well, loving your profession.
What's special about the restaurant Arzak is that it's got such a history. I think, if I don't remember wrong, you are the fourth generation working there. When you think of the heritage, how much freedom do you think it gives you? Or is it more about that you can't make drastic changes in the way the restaurant works and what the food is being served over there, considering how long it's been there?
Today I work in a tandem with my father Juan Mari, and you know, I'm very lucky because I've been always very lucky, because since the beginning, the first plate I made with him, I think I was 19 years old. And my father always let me make a lot of introduce new ideas, no? And for example, the first plate I made with him, I was 19. It was a salad of tuna with vegetables. He liked very much the salad. It was with vegetables in the form of a mountain, but he didn't like the sauce, so he changed me the sauce. And of course, you have to have respect for the professionals and for the chefs that work for a long time, and this is what I did. He believed in me, but I had respect in his working, no? And today is a day we still work in the tandem with our team. This is one of the reasons why I stayed in the restaurant and I didn't go abroad and I didn't go away, because I felt me very realized to practice a lot of ideas, no?
Can you tell me about the dynamics when you are working with your father? Is someone learning from someone, and who is making the final decisions on what is actually being done?
We are the opinion you learn from everybody, no? I learn from him. He says he learned from me, no? Because he's always listened to the younger people, because the younger people, they can give you new ideas, no? And new ways and new exits. Otherwise, if you make the same, you always turn in the same circle, no? But, of course, my father is very, very good. Well, he is 71 years old. He doesn't want to retire. And he has a lot. He's very modern, incredible for his age. He has always been capable to be up to date without problem, no? So this is why it was never difficult for me to work with him. And it's fantastic, and I like his way of being, no? He still thinks he's still learning, no? And this is why he transmits to all the team in Arzak.
And now you are indeed in London back again, and you have a project going on with Ahmet's restaurant. What can you tell about that?
Oh, well, in this moment, I'm talking to you, sitting next to Sergio Sanz, he's the head chef in Ametsa, and we are lucky. And you know, coming for me back to London is always very nice, no? As I explained, from one side, I have very good memories, and my father as well. He when he was younger, he trained in Talston next to Preston in a restaurant, and when 3 months. And then, you know, what we are doing in Ametsa, we are doing a gastronomic consulting that is by Arzak Instruction. Arzak Instruction is a company that we have created for making consultings, advising gastronomic, and is what we are doing. We are my father and me with 3 other chefs, Mikel Sorazu, Xavier Gutierrez, Igor Zalacain. The most that comes is Mikel Sorazu, that comes up and down, and the rest we take turns. We are really very happy with this project, and Sergio Sanz and the rest of the team are here. We have designed the menu with them, and you know, we give the personal touch. We are very committed, and you know, we have a lot of illusion for this project.
Chef Eleanor Arzak there was speaking to our own Marcus Hippie, and you can catch the full interview on this week's edition of The Menu. It premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this to explore the chairs, sofas, lights and interiors of Helsinki's Habitare.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Côte d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set. This means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's Sporting Report and over 350 more films on Monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House, where it's 8:40 in London and 10:40 a.m. in Helsinki. That's where we're heading now.
Yeah, exhibiting everything from lamps to fireplaces and sinks to saunas. I know which one I prefer out of those. Habitare is Finland's largest interior decoration and design fair.
The annual event attracts tens of thousands of visitors, running the gamut from industry insiders to enthusiastic renovators, all keen to take the temperature of the Finnish design scene. Here's Monocle's Josh Fennett.
In Helsinki's exhibition centre, 5 kilometres north of the city proper, droves of design aficionados are finding shelter from the rain outside, among the pavilions of some of the country's best-known brands. I stopped by the Artex stall in Hall 7, to see what news of the Finnish homeware giant's recent takeover by Swiss firm Vitra might mean for its future.
My name is Ville Kokkonen. I work as the design director for Artek. I'm an industrial designer and have been working at Artek since 2005.
And we're obviously here at Habitare, which is a big design fair in Finland. I was wondering what you kind of see its relevance as in these modern times. Obviously Maison et Objet is a big event that was a couple of weeks ago. Is there still an important place for designers at Habitare?
Yes, I believe there is. It has its particular function since not every single year big groups of architects, interior designers or our clients have the chance to visit Milan Fair or the fair in Japan or the fairs in Cologne and elsewhere in Germany. It plays a good role for those people that they see each year what was showcased in Milan for the companies that do have an international audience. But it also works and functions as a fair for smaller companies that are still starting and maybe cannot afford yet to make a bigger international launch.
Obviously, Finnish design is in the news to some extent recently. Artek has been taken over. There's a new collaboration with, should I say, Swiss firm Vitra. I mean, what does that spell for the future? Are you excited about the collaboration?
Yes, indeed. We at Artek are very excited. Of course, we had a great collaboration with the previous owners, but this is something that touched us as well, since Vitra has an incredible heritage as well. We share very many similar values.
Next, to Finnish favourites Marimekko to talk textiles and tableware and all the fun of the fair.
So my name is Maria Järkkä and I work for Marimekko for the design department. I work as a product development manager there.
I wonder what you think the importance is of exhibiting here at home at Habitare. What kind of role does it play, the kind of domestic trade fair?
For us this is very important because Marimekko is kind of like a national heritage already. It's owned by every Finnish citizen, so to say. Old brand, already 60 years old brand. People are very interested in what we are doing. But now this collection is a bit different than what we have been doing earlier. And we want to show the variety or how we are able to work in different styles as well. Very colorful and kind of a playful designs, but then also this kind of a subtle, sophisticated patterns. So this is very important for us to show our customers in Finland how broad our visual world is really.
Beyond the big names, Habitare offers a wealth of smaller designers from at home and abroad the opportunity to share their wares with the wider market. As Dominic Fitch, CEO of Helsinki-based retailer Out of the Dark, explains.
It's a new brand that basically is taking what we believe to be the best of the best from around the world, from young designers, well-known designers, and curating it to create an Out of the Dark collection.
So you mentioned that you previously owned a similar business in the UK and you were lucky enough to sell it before the recession. Can you tell me a tiny bit about that and why you think Finland might be a kind of fertile ground to start a new venture?
Well, basically, yes, I did have a very similar company to this in the UK for almost 20 years. And I just decided that with the impact of the recession in Western Europe, that I wanted to work in a new territory, somewhere where I felt that we could really do something new and different. And we picked Helsinki, mainly because there is a very, very strong design community here historically, and very, very good Finnish designers. Basically, Habitare is only once a year, so it's not like most of Western Europe where you get 10 spring, summer and an autumn winter show. So basically, this is the only place. If you want to showcase your company, your brand, this is the only place to come.
Next, I spoke to Petra Karjalainen, CEO of Homecrafts, a brand that curates and sells the work of Finnish artisans. I asked her what role the fair plays to a business like hers.
I think it's very, very important for, at least for the Finnish market. We have to be here. It's very expensive, but we have to be here. And we have many people like you from other countries, and I think we made a really great success now, this Habitare. People see us the first time. We were actually last year already, but now we got through it.
And people are getting behind the idea of entrepreneurship. That's something that we kind of try to do our bit for at Monocle as well. But the people are supportive of your mission to support these craftspeople?
Actually, that's our, yeah. We have this vision that we have to help people in the countryside, not only in the big towns where people get work easier. And we would love to have everything produced only in the countryside.
And do Finnish handicrafts have a bright future, in your opinion?
In my opinion, yes. But we have to do something about it.
From headline-making mergers to getting companies off the ground, Habitare might not have the glitz of Milan or the prestige of Paris, but it still means business in this part of the world. For Monocle, in Helsinki, I'm Josh Fennett.
Josh was reporting from Helsinki, and there's more design delights on next Tuesday's Section D, of course, covering London's Design Festival and a lot more.
Up next, we'll be reviewing the European newspapers, but first, some music. This is the Zwet remix of Another Love by Tom Odell.
I wanna take you somewhere, so you know I care, but it's so cold and I don't know where. I brought you daffodils on a pretty string, but they won't flower like they last spring. I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright. I'm just so tired to share my nights. I wanna cry and I wanna love, but all my tears have been used up. On another love, all my tears be used all on another love, all my tears have been used all on another love, all my tears have been used all. And I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright.
open store on another love, another love. Oh, my tears have been used up on another love, another love. Oh, my tears have been used up.
That was the Zwet remix of Another Love by Tom Odell, and you are listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Cordelia Lynch. French and Spanish newspapers this morning. Daphne Denis is here. How are you, Daphne?
I'm very good indeed, Dom.
Excellent.
I'm afraid we have a very French newspaper review today, actually.
Should we backtrack?
I've bailed on Spain.
Some French and no Spanish newspapers today. Take it away,
next
Daphne.
Next time. Okay, shall we start with Libération, which is one of my favourite newspapers in France. Today they report on Hollande in Mali, congratulating himself for his action there. Hollande is happy with himself in Mali. That's the title of the article. So obviously, François Hollande was at IBK's inauguration yesterday, and he said he was really happy with what he did in Mali, and then sort of tried to say that he'd really like to do it in Syria and maybe in Central African Republic as well.
And this is, of course, the French military operation to prevent Islamist militants from taking over the West African country. But perceived by commentators, too, as probably his most striking success of his 16-month tenure.
Definitely. I think that's what really brought French people behind him. He's been a very unpopular president. And when he intervened in Mali, the intervention was snappy, was good. It happened really quickly. And I think the French were surprised to have a president that was able to pull that off.
Surprised that he was able to pull that off. But how do they feel about the sort of he is pleased with himself. There's a picture of him looking pleased with himself in the paper that you've selected for us. But this idea that this success could end up turning into other operations, or at least the desire for other operations elsewhere. How's that going down?
Syria is not something that the French want. They don't want to go there, much like the Americans. It seems like a bit of a can of worms, to be honest. It's not the same thing. And I'm not sure about the other countries. What's a bit odd is that Hollande talks in a very colonialist way. Like he said that he also wanted to reinforce his presence in the Central African Republic, and sort of said that, you know, France needs to step up. And it's unclear why. I mean, yes, of course, there's countries that have troubles, but why should France go is unclear.
As in, this is action for its own sake. He's felt he's got this bounce in the polls, and he's feeling good about this particular military success. Now he thinks, well, maybe this is what I'll do then. I'll be the guy. I'll be the intervention guy.
I'll go to war. That's what I'll do.
And he certainly needs to justify and elevate, I guess, his sort of international statesmanlike quality and instill confidence in what he's doing, because let's face it, with Syria, it's flown in the face of many other countries' decisions.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he obviously felt a little bit left on the sidelines there. He really wants to go there. Actually, I think he said this morning that he also was not against arming the rebels, including jihadis. So yes, he really wants to go.
Another interesting thing happening domestically in France, a new figure on the right that's courting some attention.
So this is for the Parisian mayoral election that's happening in less than 6 months. NKM is one of the women of the right. So I don't know if you know, but the French government, which is left wing, has lots of women. And France, the French right is trying to sort of equal and get there as well and have lots of women on the spotlight. But NKM, Nathalie Kosciusko-Morizet, who's got such a difficult name that you have to make it three letters instead.
That even the French struggle.
NKM. she's a really interesting person because she's very dynamic, very young, more open than most other people. And the news here in Le Monde says that she is still failing to get the right together. So the right's having lots of problems of cohesion since Sarkozy left. There's on one side Fillon, who's very sort of traditional, but perhaps more moderate. There's Copé, who's more sort of tending towards a hard right. And then there's the center. And so the French right is really, really divided. And it's even reflecting in the municipal elections.
Talk to us about the role of Paris mayor. How significant is it? She is going up against another female challenger, the deputy mayor at the moment, I believe. Yeah. How's that likely to play out?
I think the left has its chances. I think it's going to be difficult to get the left out of Paris because Bertrand Delanoë has done really well for Paris. I mean, he's the man who's been there for ages. He's behind the project of Le Grand Paris. He's behind the Vélib, etc. So I think it's going to be difficult to get the left out of Paris.
Okay. If I were a French farmer looking for love,
maybe away from the urban.
Let's leave the capital.
What should I do?
Huh? I love this.
I think this weekend you should go to Baraqueville.
Okay.
And you should go meet your love and aggregating.
Of course.
Aggregating. I mean, we have something similar in the UK in that they say the young, well, so I hear, young farmers in the union, they'll have their, discos makes me sound terribly old-fashioned.
Discos.
Let's not use the word disco, but they have their dances and nights together. And, you know, of course, it's a big issue because they're separated from
exactly.
fast
people
ways
that,
of land.
You know, they work all day. They're alone. They hang out with cows. And obviously they feel a bit lonely. And they have trouble finding their other half. So to help that, there's been this event called Aggregating in lots of different provinces of France. The aim of it, though, is more interesting than it sounds. It's not just for them to find love, which is nice, but it's also because lots of small towns are losing all of their people and schools are closing down, shops are closing down, and that's because people are not having kids, because they're lonely. So Aggregating is trying to solve that problem. But at the same time, they have lots of activities. They're going to...
Well, this is what I'm interested in. What sort of activities might go on my aggregating day? I'm quite excited already.
My favourite one is that they're going to go
bow and arrow firing.
Yeah. Bow and arrow firing, yes.
Wow, a sort of literal Cupid vibe going on in the fields.
It's very cheesy and very cute. I think that's lovely, you know. I would go aggregating if I
were a farmer. You're a journalist. You'll have to go journal dating instead.
Tough enough to find love in the city. Thank you very much, Daphne. Really interesting. That's all we have time for today. And thanks to our producer, Alid John, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Matt Alagaya, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell.
Next up after the news, it's a special edition of Section D. This week, it's coming from Lisbon's third Architecture Triennale. And Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. From Cordelia and from me, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.